It is back to school time, and I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but if you look at just recent years here in Connecticut and probably across the country, I don't want to talk out of turn, swatting incidents have become far too common. And so we thought this should be a conversation we have with our FBI right here in the New Haven office. We welcome back to the show Special Agent in Charge PJ O'Brien, as well as Public Affairs Specialist Christine Jeltema. I don't know if we've already had any swatting incidents. We're only a few days into the school year, some starting today. How are you both?
Doing well. Yourself?
Doing fine. Thank you so much. First of all, let's start with the basics of what actually is swatting, because we hear about it a lot, but maybe people don't necessarily know what exactly that means.
Sure. Swatting is when a call or report goes to a local police department reporting that there's an incident, usually something like an active shooter or a bomb threat, and the goal is to evoke a response from that department and cause disruption through it. So it's an intentional act of trying to get a fairly large-scale police response, normally targeting sensitive locations like schools.
Why has it become more and more, I don't want to use the word popular, why is it happening more and more, it seems?
It's definitely more prevalent. And
prevalent, there's the word.
I think a big part of it is the anonymous nature of how it's done and the increased number of vectors that you could do that now. Between utilizing VPNs and utilizing AI to do voice changes and the like, assigning your own phone numbers, you have this pick your own phone number where you can make something appear as if you're local, even when you are across the country or across the world. So the amount of tools that are available to help empower folks to do this, likewise, it's become a cultural thing, especially within, you know, the gamer and online forum, you know, like Discord and the like community, where in order to settle grievances, in order to put folks in a bad position, exploiting their personal information and oftentimes making it appear as they're either the subject of the swatting or they are the person who's going to carry out the violent act in order to evoke that law enforcement response and also put them in a bad position. So a lot of it comes from that online ecosystem within the dark web and chat rooms and the like. It's almost like one-upsmanship too, where a lot of folks are out there and it's you're part of a group and you evoked a certain response, and now the other people in the group are trying to match that and see how they could get it, what publicity they could get. So it almost becomes a competition amongst the actors.
Because I was going to ask, like, what is even the point? So it sounds really silly to even ask that question. I mean, as you mentioned, PJ, it creates havoc. It disrupts people's livelihoods. But I don't even understand. I get that it kind of started from like the gaming industry, if you will, or kind of, I guess, chat rooms, you know, as mentioned. But what is sort of the point? Because the other thing that's really confusing about swatting is a lot of the times it's not even somebody who lives in that district or even in that state. I mean, a lot of times we'll hear about swatting incidents in Connecticut, but it's somebody who's across the country or even in another country. So I don't, like, what's the point?
Yeah, to cause the disruption. So a lot of times when you look at the gaming part of it, it's these maybe extremists that are they're targeting a person. And like PJ said, that person being targeted, they try to make them feel like there's, if they don't do something, this is what we're going to do. We're going to cause this chaos, like whether they're the subject or they're a victim of something that's going on. And that's when they do these swatting calls. And it doesn't only affect that person. It affects the law enforcement community,
right,
the community itself, the school community, or whichever location they're doing the swatting. And it's a huge burden on everybody that's involved in this.
So is it random, or is it usually, so a swatting incident happens, let's just say, or even we'll back up. So the three of us are playing in a video game chat room. Can you tell that I clearly don't really play too often? More than Mario Kart, I will say. But we all live in different states. We're all playing, though, on whatever platform. And I want to pick a bone with you, Christine. And so wherever your state is, you live over here. Is it as simple as that you would do a swatting incident impacting somewhere in your state or just your town to get back at you? Is it like that, or do they just sort of pick a random, regardless if you, if the three of us have beef, we're just going to pick a random place to create havoc? Is it a little bit of both? Like, what leads to, I guess, a swatting incident? Why would that even happen?
It could be both.
It could be both.
The early genesis of this threat was gamers sort of during the game itself trying to target one another and get the response to the physical location where their counterpart was actually on the game.
That's crazy.
So that's sort of where it started. And then it sort of came into, you know, how can we get retribution for, you know, losing the round of Call of Duty? Or, and then in the worst case scenario, really goes to that genesis of larger disruption where it is group organized. And yes, it can be random and oftentimes is. Many times there are connections between those who are the targets or seemingly carrying out the violent act with those who are reporting it and doing the swatting. The worst case scenario, though, is when we get into that nihilistic, disruptive behavior where it's group driven, where, you know, whether it's through extortion or through pressure, that those who are carrying it out are actually also being victimized at the same time by those in the online community who are pressuring them.
Wow.
In order to take that on.
How do you combat that then?
It's very difficult.
I would think so.
A lot of ways.
I would think so.
Parent interaction, parent involvement. You know, I can't think of a lot of good reasons why a 13-year-old needs a VPN. You know, watching, you know, money transfers, you know, a lot of times, you know, currency in these systems are Apple gift cards. Seeing some of those warnings and indicators as to what's going on, changes of behavior, being, you know, more and more isolated, spending more time online, you know, it really does start with the parents in terms of initial detection, and then obviously with the local police departments and, you know, the school resource officers and all of those front-end first responders who are most affected by this. And then obviously the Bureau will have its role looking at it in a more universal standpoint, trying to tie swatting incidents across the country together and looking at ways of sort of disrupting those organizations who are driving it, and then finding those real persistent actors who are targeting multiple school districts or multiple entities across the country.
So we are talking about swatting incidents. In fact, the Department of Justice released a new document recently, or at least over the summertime, just talking about the prevalence of swatting. I don't have specific statistics how many times we see swatting incidents in Connecticut, but I can say from a news standpoint, it feels like we talk about swatting pretty frequently, especially the beginning of the school year and towards the end of the school year. Joining us back on the show from the FBI New Haven office is Special Agent in Charge PJ O'Brien, as well as Public Affairs Specialist Christine Jeltema. Let's talk about the response, because I think the more and more people learn about swatting, the more they think, well, it's clearly not real. And why do we respond the way that we do? I think it's important to kind of hint that when you first get these calls or you first get that, you know, alleged threat, I think people would be upset to know that police just kind of write it off versus responding. Correct? I mean, you guys could speak a lot better to that than I can.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially with the sensitive locations that most swatting incidents revolve around. No municipality is going to take lightly a threat to a school system. The hardest thing you could do in law enforcement at times is proving a negative. And, you know, a lot of research gets done as well. So the callers now will provide a lot of details, you know, with the amount of imagery that's available through open source. They can give a certain level of specificity now that they've never been able to give before that really gives some veracity to the reporting. So as that 911 dispatcher is getting the call, as their responding officers are getting initial information, things that they're saying about, you know, the mascot statue next to the flagpole, that, you know, and folks who are responding that are familiar with these locations are hearing, you know, yeah, I know that entrance. There's the flagpole with the mascot stat. I know exactly where I'm going. So as you're getting that certain amount of information that makes it appear, you know, realistic, you just can't take the chance that one of these is not real. So obviously all the departments are going to take a a logical approach to addressing these. And in the beginning, it sort of went from 0 to 100 really quickly, where tactical teams and bomb squads were being, you know, sent out and deployed. Each one of these is going to be taken seriously, but I think now we are at a stage where there's more of a staggered response to it. And our goal from our messaging standpoint, and we've done a tremendous amount of outreach in the last year, trying to hit every level from superintendents to the educator community, to the SROs, to school security, to the local departments, working in connection with the Connecticut Intelligence Center and Connecticut mm-hmm. State Police and DESP and the like, of just, you know, messaging and socializing what this is so that everyone can sort of come up with their own plans. But at the end of the day, certain calls are going to revoke certain responses, and they're not going to take the chance with that. And that's really what the perpetrators prey upon, is they know. And that's the sad part of it. But at the end of the day, all we could really do is try as much as we can to educate and message, be there as a resource, try to support anytime we have intelligence regarding a new actor or a new tradecraft or something to look out for. We utilize our intelligence program and utilize CTIC and other venues in order to send that message out statewide to make sure that we can make the departments and the school districts as knowledgeable as possible as they're working through their emergency plans. But at the end of the day, they're going to, and they should, follow their plans and protocols, because you don't want to get one of these wrong. God forbid something actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
You want to make sure that the response is appropriate to what the threat is.
I think the thing that bothers me about it, well, there's a lot to bother people about it, is that you are draining your immediate resources to respond to something that a lot of times doesn't end up being anything. And I always wonder, you know, what is that backup system for people who don't know, maybe. So say there's a swatting incident at your child's school, you know, that whole department is pretty much, I would think, responding. But then who backs up the department that's now responding to this? Because isn't part of the chaos is knowing that you've drained your resources and God forbid something else happens, car crash, what have you, in the same municipality. What is sort of the backup? How does that kind of work?
And listen, we're really fortunate. Like, number one, Connecticut is one of the safest states in the nation. So the crime rate here is phenomenal. The local departments, Connecticut State Police, have done a tremendous job with driving crime down. We see that also nationally in terms of what the national trends are. Murders at the lowest rate that it's been since the 50s. Robberies, acts of violence, murder, you know, all the big index crimes are down, and a tremendous amount of work has been done. That's not to say law enforcement officers aren't busy, though. And that cascade that you laid out is not insignificant. Now, there are standing mutual aid agreements mm-hmm. between town to town and town to state
mm-hmm.
to make sure that there are adequate resources as you go through one of these. But something as simple as a responding emergency vehicle, that could cause a motor vehicle accident. You know, there's other second and third order events that could happen
mm-hmm.
through the course of running that call down that do have an immense risk with any call that comes in. But they are a massive resource drain, because by the nature of what's being called in, it is going to evoke a fairly large, if not response, at least preparation.
Mm-hmm.
So if a warning call goes out, those bomb technicians or tactical teams or special resources that might go to that problem, if it's real,
mm-hmm.
are breaking away from other things that they're doing. And for most part, usually those are collateral duties. It's not as if those are officers who are just sitting on their kit waiting for the call.
Right.
You know, they're working a static location, maybe assisting with buses moving from a depot, maybe, you know, working a traffic detail where kids are crossing a street that's dangerous. So, you know, they may have to, you know, move from that to prepare to potentially do something high risk. But now the purpose for while they were there can't be fully addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, you could have that incident that some other accident or crime happens because these resources were pulled off and redirected in an unnecessary manner.
To bring it back to an earlier point you guys made, which is having, I'd say, more parental guidance involved in this or combating this effectively, what would you want to leave with listeners as we're starting a new school year? Swatting, unfortunately, has become far too common. and we know kind of, at least in some regard, where it's coming from. And even if it's not somebody directly in your kid's school or in your state, we know how, in some regard, we're ending up on the radar. So what would you suggest people to do?
I would say, as a parent, you know, be knowledgeable of your child's activities. Monitor what they're doing. Speak with them. You know, ask them. Find out, you know, if they're encountering any issues or bullying. And really have that engagement. Build that level of trust. Take some of the stigma out away from it, where if they are struggling with something, that they feel comfortable talking about it. But obviously there's, you know, lots of commercial monitoring software things and the like that you could do and put on phones and computers. But really be knowledgeable. You know, you wouldn't just blindly allow your child to go to someone's house that you didn't know. But oftentimes you are blindly allowing them to interact with people online. And those environments are equally dangerous. Mm. And you just need to make that investment in their safety and security and really be proactive with them in order to just keep them safe. And that's really that engagement and activity and that recognition that monitoring the online environment is one that you need to be on top of is something that you know, we highly endorse.
Yeah. It's such a good comparison. I always think of when you ask somebody if you would hand your 4 or 5 year old a glass of vodka and they look at you like you're crazy. And I think, but you handed them a tablet.
Right.
And people think I'm nuts, but I say, I'm like, look, they're both very addictive in nature. If you're not on top of it or you're not aware of it, you know, you're handing something to somebody that adults don't even have under control. So to your point, you know, would you drop your kid off at a house that they don't know the parents, they don't know the kid, they don't know anything about? No, that's crazy. Why would you even ask that? Well, that's what they're doing.
With tablets and phones and internet, you're doing that in their own house.
Right.
They're sitting in their bedroom with an open door to a community that is far more reaching than somebody's house that's in the local neighborhood.
And it's a false sense of security because your child might be home, but what they could be exposed to while they're online. And all of these tools are phenomenal, right? You know, the tablets, the internet, the phones, you know, the mechanisms that we have to communicate, the availability of information. And, you know, it's all great. You know, use the right way.
Mm-hmm.
But it also creates a whole suite of vulnerabilities now that we just have to accept as, you know, parents and members of the public and take on that personal responsibility, whether it's, you know, taking those things to safeguard our own information. And as we spoke about in the past, doing things like strong passwords and two-factor authentication. But at the end of the day, you know, your access to your bank account shouldn't be more thorough than your knowledge of what your child is doing online.
Yeah, it's a good point. I want to thank you both so much again from the FBI New Haven office, Special Agent in Charge PJ O'Brien and Public Affairs Specialist Christine Geltimo. We appreciate you guys always making the time to come on the show. Thank you.
Thank you.